Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the fluff on my stylus. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, how are you, mate?
I'm all right, thank you very much. How are you?
Good. Looking forward to this.
You're looking very smart in the hair department. I like the way you've combed it back and you look slick.
Do you know what? I just got caught outside in the rain about 10 minutes
ago. Oh, did you?
Ago. That's all it was, yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You look slick. It suits you. And I'm
there
glad
no
that you...
back.
I'm glad that you've made an effort because today is a special day and obviously our guest, I'm sure, will appreciate the effort and the style that you've gone to.
Well, let's find out. And it is a special day because our guest today is a legend in the world of dance music. A superstar DJ, a record producer, and an actual lawyer. And I mean like a proper one, like a real lawyer. Mm. He's the judge that won't budge. It is, of course, the one and only Judge Jules. Hi, Jules. How are you?
Jules, please. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a while, Jules, since we have seen each other and since we have spoken. How's life? How are you and the family?
All good. Yeah, I live this strange dual existence of being a specialist music lawyer and still a DJ after many decades doing loads and loads of gigs. I'm fairly confident, actually, there's not anybody else mad enough in the entire world to do the combo of things that I do.
I must admit, it is a strange combo, isn't it? Because a lawyer's job ain't an easy job. It's not like a 2 days a week job, is it?
Mm. No, I reckon I put in a shift of about 80 hours a week of the two combined.
Yeah.
For those that don't realise, obviously the Judge Jules name stems from the fact that, you know, you have a legal background. You presumably sort of parked that for many years, obviously, when, you know, the DJing and that career took off. At what point did you revert back to sort of incorporating that into your life?
I've been doing it about 12 years. I mean, the point I need to make is that I'm a music lawyer and I predominantly deal with electronic music. So actually the distinction between my two careers is far narrower than it would appear. Right. I guess the thing for me was I hit my sort of early 30s and there weren't that many DJs sort of older than me. I guess the key sort of older DJs than me who are still around now would be probably Carl Cox, Paul Oakenfold and Pete Tong. So there wasn't much of a kind of career structure to look at and think, well, you know, in 20 years time, will I still be doing this? And so I thought I need to sort of stay in the music business, use my skill set, dare I say, use my brain. So I went back to night school, didn't tell anybody, retrained as a lawyer. Assume that by this point I probably wouldn't be DJing very much, but of course the great unknown was the fact that nobody else, including me, actually wanted to stop going out. So, you know, my market is the over 35s now, but there's just a massively buoyant market in over 35 events. I mean, the thought of me when I was, you know, when I was a kid, my parents going out with me or them going out to clubs and shaking a leg is like butt clenching me abhorrent as a concept. But actually, you know, that's what happens now. I think it's a wholly different attitude. Raving is so much part of, so ingrained in people's DNA that they don't simply stop. You get a period when people stop around, probably when they sort of couple up and have kids, because when you've got very small children, it's not easy. But then eventually, A, you can't wait to be released again. And B, when you sort of trust somebody, be it a relative or a sitter or anybody else, in fact, to look after your kids, you go out again, you think, wow, actually, I really miss this. And there's a whole ecosystem of those sort of events here in the UK, but also in other countries, all other key countries with kind of big dance music cultures, like Down Under, the US to a point. And it's kind of evolved. And when I first started doing it, it was started doing these older people's gigs. It was a case of having to play the kind of records they'd heard first time around. But it's developed way beyond that. So, of course, you need some touch points with people's youth. But at the same time, people have the crowds I'm playing to anyway, and it's sort of week in, week out, are very open-minded now. So it's a real, you know, I just never anticipated. I suppose in retrospect, in the cold light of day, it was probably fairly predictable that people would still want to do this. So my attempt to have this kind of crossfade between careers, to continue my DJ metaphor, they both existed. They're both now still in the mix together.
it's just endless, isn't it?
It's like a script, and it's not even like that. But it's funny though, isn't it, Jules? Because it's like everything you say. It's like because 50 feels very different now. You know, when we were kids and when we were sort of in our 20s and whatever, 50 seemed ancient. You know, 50 was like, you know. But now it's like, as you say, you know, 50, you're kind of thinking, well, no, do you know what? People are still lively and young and they want to go out and stuff. And, you know, what you're doing and, you know, what people like Annie Mack are doing as well with her kind of like raves, which finish at midnight, you know, so that people can get back for their sitters and all this. It's a, you know, it's an interesting market, as you say.
Yeah. And the irony is actually that, that the younger market, the sort of under 30 market, all go out much earlier anyway. If you were to put a festival on 20 years ago that closed at midnight, you just wouldn't have sold a ticket, literally. But now, and I know this from having kids who are in their sort of late teens, they come in before I do. They're all sort of preening in front of the mirror. Mm. They're the sort of love the buffed up Love Island generation who couldn't possibly have a late night or get a bit wasted because it might kind of destroy the looks for Instagram.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. It's the Instagram and TikTok generation who just...
Is that what you reckon?
There are one or two bits of YouTube footage for me when I was younger where in those interviews I was probably a bit half cut, but thankfully there's very little evidence of, you know, from that era to kind of incriminate us. Now there is just evidence wherever you look. So it is, I mean, there are many reasons why current generations don't go out as late. There's kind of pool party culture, which emanated, I guess, from Vegas and has become very big in Ibiza as well, with Ocean Beach and kind of those sort of venues. But it's a really different environment from the way it was before. Mm.
So Jules, where's home now? I mean, is it still Ibiza or are you backwards and forwards? Or
I live part in London and I live part in Mallorca. Mallorca is like a more mature take on Ibiza. Ibiza's the best place on earth to go out for 48 hours, but actually when you hit the winter is a bit tumbleweed like, and some people, you know, some residents in Ibiza love that. They love the fact that the tourists have gone home and they can do nothing and they can just hang out drinking a glass of wine with their mates. But I think when you're fundamentally a city person like I am, an island like Mallorca, which has got a city of 500,000 or 600,000 people in the shape of Palma de Mallorca, which is like a mini Barcelona, and it's just never closes down, and it's got the kind of creature comforts of living all the unglamorous stuff, like having an IKEA and having, you know, equivalent to Tesco superstores, but also shopping malls like a La Liga football team, all that sort of stuff that makes it a really livable place. So I live a bizarre life where I probably spend a couple of days there a week, and then the rest of the week in London in my office. And of course, popping up and down the country, DJing as well.
Well, that's the thing, you know. And I was looking on your website before because, you know, and it is regular, isn't it? I mean, it's not sort of, you know, gigs sort of every so often. It's pretty much every weekend you seem to be out going somewhere.
It is. I probably do about 100 gigs a year, which is still a bit of a shock to me because that certainly wasn't the way it was planned. I mean, with every passing year or decade, I think, no chance will I be doing this in 10 years' time, and roll forward the clock. And here I still am sort of propping up the decks.
Great.
And long may that continue. Do you know what? If you love something and it keeps on going.
Yeah, ultimately you can't fool anybody. You can't stand there looking like a sort of tired old frump. You're either into it or you're not.
Yeah. No, it's also really interesting what you say about, you know, the phones and the fact that, you know, I guess that has sort of shaped the attitudes of, you know, the generation now in their teens and their 20s, because unlike when we were there, as you say, we could do what we wanted. And then there was no worry about, unless you physically were stood next to me and kind of saw me at that age, then that's it. There's no evidence of it now. Whereas I suppose they're just programmed whereby anything that happens is then recorded and then posted on social media and exists forever. And that obviously shapes what people do, or indeed what they don't do.
And how boring what they don't do has become.
Thank God phones weren't around when we were up to, you know what I mean, going out and having fun. Thank the Lord.
No, it's absolutely true. Right, listen, Jules, let's talk cars, because this is loosely a car-based podcast. I mean, it's more about just us sort of blathering about what we've been talking about so far. But let's get on to cars. I know it's a while ago now, but do you remember the momentous day that you passed your test, and how many attempts did you have?
I passed it first time, and I'm not lying, I did.
Okay.
I do, and I remember that my driving instructor wouldn't allow me to drive home from the test, the theory being that you're in that much of a state of elation, you'd be more likely to crash at that point than at any other time in the car with your instructor.
Well, that makes sense. I was third time. I messed up twice. But yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, you just got your ticket because it's a big rite of passage, isn't it?
Yeah,
first time
it is.
I think probably the first time you feel real freedom.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm from London, and one of the great luxuries then, and to an extent now, I know because one of my kids recently passed their test, is the ability to go to try and pick the driving test centre that is easiest. And in North London, where I'm from, there's a real, you know, there's one at, or back in the day, I think they're still there. There's one at Mill Hill, which involves going up the A1 on a 6-lane road. And then there was one in Burnt Oak, which involved pottering around a few back streets. And of course, any sane person went for the latter, as I did. But I still find it a bit strange because, you know, fast forward 20 odd years when my daughter was doing her test, and the same sort of ease of choice, you know, only a no-brain choice of going to the easiest possible test center was available to her.
That's still a thing.
Yeah,
that's still a thing then now, even now. Wow.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, if you come from somewhere with only one test center, if you come from smaller cities or countryside or what have you, you don't have that choice. I guess if you come from a smaller city, you've also got less traffic to contend with in your test and arguably less sort of things that might go wrong.
I would imagine, actually, just thinking about the traffic and the stress, I would imagine passing a test in London is somewhat more difficult than it might be in Derbyshire or Newcastle. Mm.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
The volume of traffic, and everyone's a bit arsey, aren't they? Mm. Yeah, everyone's just got a bit of attitude in London on the roads.
Yeah, I mean, I've never taken my test anywhere else, so I can only speculate.
Well, do you know what I did for a magazine one of the motor racing rags? They said, look, why don't we let's see if you could pass your test again? That was a negative, Ghost Rider.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could either. I don't think I could because there's so many things and there's so many sort of bad habits, I guess, that you get into. Yeah. That are just an instant, you know, even just the way you hold the wheel, I suppose, is probably an instant. I don't mean you personally, Jason, but the way that one holds the wheel probably isn't exactly where it should be at 10 to 2.
Well, that is a thing, you know, that they want you to feed the wheel. And in my game, that's just not what you do.
Yeah,
and actually, you shouldn't be feeding the wheel anyway. I mean, that's old hat. You know, that's for cars with no power steering and all the rest of it. So, you know, the driving test should be brought up to the current standard. I personally think that, you know, a few of us, Dave, Judge, some of our other mates, basically everyone that's been on this podcast should be allowed to do 120 mile an hour on the motorways at night or more.
This is why you're not an MP.
I think I made a great transport minister.
Jules,
everyone must drive V8s.
Jules, what was the first car then? Where did the automotive journey begin
Well,
for you?
It was quite sad for me, I guess, because my mother died when I was 18 and I inherited her car. And it wasn't the world's best car. It was a Citroën. It was new-ish, but it was certainly in an era when the French reputation for non-existent build quality was forged. It meant a lot to me because obviously losing your mother at that age, quite young, not many of my mates had lost a parent. Real emotional attachment. But on the other hand, the car was utter rubbish. It really was. Broke down.
Yeah. Do you remember what Citroën it was?
It was a Citroën Visa. I do. I mean, Visa's got this international kind of feeling about it. But I assure you, it wouldn't have got from A to B, let alone to France.
I remember those, actually.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, and testament to the build quality or lack of it, you don't see any of them now, do you? You know, you don't see any of them kicking around in classic shows these days.
In fact, the old Citroëns now are really groovy, aren't they? You know, if you had a DS or something now, you'd be pretty cool in one of those.
I did briefly as well.
I think it's a phrase.
I briefly had a Citroën 2CV as well, which, I mean, in slightly less sad circumstances, I inherited from my grandmother who lived in Spain. She died in her mid-80s, so there was no sort of sadness in, and we drove it over and it had sort of Malaga number plates and And I had another car at the time, but it was just a bit of a novelty periodically going down to gigs. I had a sort of BMW or something fairly generic at the time, but I went to the occasional gig in this Citroen left-hand drive Citroen 2CV with those rolly roofs just for the fun of it. Yeah, I mean, it blew around. Yeah. You know, paper in the wind probably wouldn't have blown around as much as this car, but it was, yeah, you don't see, you occasionally see them in Balearic Islands kind of pottering around in the countryside, but they are...
Yeah,
they've sort of been forgotten about, haven't they? The legendary 2CV.
Mm. Do you know what? I've got nothing but affection for them because I had one when I was at college and it was just the funniest, best thing. I'd put a fiver in. It would like last more than a week or two, in fact. Do you know what I mean? And I think I managed to get mine up to 70, I think.
And this, because my grandmother had had it, I mean, it was like 20 years old, but it had done like 18,000 kilometres. It was like, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Is the reason, Jason, why you don't see it's basically has rust knackered most of them? Is that why the few that are still around are probably in hotter climes where they haven't been eaten from the inside?
Yeah, I would think so. Do you know what? Paint technology back in those days. Yeah, they're just all
salt on the roads, really. In the Mediterranean, you don't get the roads salted. Salt on the roads really bad for corrosion, isn't it?
So out of all your cars going back to what you said earlier about going to gigs, presumably you're not driving yourself, you're being driven.
Yes, and I have been for a very long time. But we're going back to an era when I just started and I did have to drive myself, which was, I suppose, it's part of cutting your teeth as a DJ.
Mm. Absolutely. So out of all the cars which have been, you know, in your little stable, have you got any faves? Anything where you know, the first car you literally got, you were, oh my God, this is me.
No, I mean, my current car, I've got a Bentley GTC convertible, which is fairly, you know, the new shape one. I've had, it's the fourth GTC I've had. Absolutely love that. I mean, I kind of drive sporty cars like a old man, really, quite slowly. But what I love about it and the new generation one is just completely from the ground up reinvention of that particular model, whereas the other three were kind of evolutions of the pre-existing model. It's got like a sports performance, but like an old sort of old man boat-like sort of American style suspension. Yeah, yeah. And there's not many other cars like that, particularly convertibles. You know, all the other sort of sporty convertibles of Porsches or all the rest of them really got very hard, sporty suspension. And for some people love that, but I just love feeling like an old man sort of floating around in my boat.
They're great wafty cars with brilliant torquey engines. I mean, it's a lovely way to travel, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, do you ever, Jules, not all the time, but when you're sort of relocating from, say, Mallorca back to the UK, do you ever drive it? Do you ever sort of do it as a road trip jump on a plane?
I've got a house with a, you know, duplicate set of everything there, you know, from decks through to clothes, through to car in Mallorca. So no, it's all literally travel with my passport and a backpack, which is quite a luxury.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just saying because, you know, of all the kind of, because that is a nice bit of kit for doing kind of nice sort of continental motoring, isn't it? You know, wafting along through France on lovely kind of smooth roads. Yeah. I mean, it's a nice thing to be in.
Yeah, I guess the only fear is in certain parts of the world, and parts of Europe, in fact, that somebody scratching up your car or what have you. Only thing about, I mean, I do have another car, but in the case of that car, I tend to take it where I think it's sensible places to take it. I mean, it is my everyday car. Yeah. I drive it every day into my office, my legal practice office. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily take it under all circumstances, which is, it's the way it is, isn't it?
And the other thing, if you're doing a trip from Spain up the way through France, you're going to get nicked in that, aren't you? Because you know what the roads are like. They're fantastic to get your toe down, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is that, you know, the French aren't known for looking after cars. As you say, if you end up kind of in somewhere that's quite busy, because it's funny though, isn't it? Because actually as a huge generalization coming up here, but, you know, unlike other European countries like the Italians or the Germans, you know, who have a real pride in their cars, the French, as a general rule, see them as functional transport, which is why when you're in somewhere like Paris or you're in somewhere like Marseille, you see these beaten up little tin cans because they park and they nudge up against other cars, and it's a functional thing, isn't it, rather than something that's to be looked after and cherished.
Yeah, also motorway driving is a thing to behold when you drive in France, notwithstanding the fact that the police are not too fond of British drivers. And whereas perhaps if you were pulled over for speeding in Spain by and you had a British number plate and a British driving license, they might tell you to be naughty and wave you off. In France, that ain't going to happen. You're going to get fined. And that road down from Calais to Paris and beyond is notorious for speed traps.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you get nicked and you haven't got cash, they escort you to the cash point because they want readies. But also, if you're in Paris, the golden rule is never put your handbrake on and leave out of gear, because it's gonna get bumped around.
Yeah,
isn't it? Because people just bump to get into gas.
Absolutely, yeah. So you're better off, you know, allowing it to move, aren't you? Because otherwise, you know, if you've got your handbrake on, you're just gonna get the front or the back end dented, which is tough. Where are you on electric cars, Jules? Is it something that you've ever...
I've got one.
Have you been down the electric route?
I've got one. I've got a BMW iX 4x4, mm-hmm. which I got on a lease, actually, quite recently. And the lease prices have gone down ridiculously compared to... It was probably 50% cheaper to lease than it would have been a year earlier, which is indicative of the lease, of the problems faced by the electric car markets. And for all the reasons, I mean, it's well publicized, but for the record, we all know why electric cars aren't doing as well as they should do. Pretty much lying about range. The paucity, even in London, a paucity of fast charging, let alone outside this country. The uncertainty regarding resale prices, the uncertainty about long-term battery life. But I get, I've got a lease. It's for a couple of years. It's a great car. Absolutely love it. And I can charge it outside my house. But if you don't have the ability to charge your electric car outside your house, which the majority of people probably don't, certainly in London, there are significant disadvantages. And I've a friend of mine, very close friend of mine, is actually got one of the most senior jobs in the British motoring industry. And I get some intel about that. And you're probably aware that the government, on the one hand, the government extended the deadline before which petrol and diesel engines can no longer be sold to 2035. Yeah. Meanwhile, imposing a penalty on the sales of the self-same vehicles that is completely unrealistic. Yeah. So the motor industry is sort of stuck up shit creek without a paddle, really, when it comes to this situation. Electric cars are fabulous. My two cars are a bit of a petrol guzzler and an electric car. So, and I can only speak really positively about the quality of the car, but it doesn't go far enough if you wanted to actually do any journey of substance. Couldn't use it to go out DJing because you can't, the range isn't good enough. And unless you go at 60 miles an hour on the motorway, can't guarantee that there'll be charging at the other end. So it's a little bit unfair on the motor industry to hold them to account when the infrastructure is not there, and nor is the technology. And we keep hearing about the golden ticket of a car with 1,000 mile range on a charge, but that's a long way off, isn't it? But something far in excess of what we have now, let's say double at least what we have now the longest range electric vehicles probably have about 350 range.
Even then, that's a bit of a fit.
Depends on the variables. Yeah. You really need double that before. I mean, there are many, many people who charge up and down the motorway for whatever reason every day doing long distance journeys, and it's unworkable. Yeah. So we all agree that it's a great thing in theory, but the practical reality is that unless you're using it like I do for relatively short journeys, and I can stick it outside the house and put it on charge, which is a luxury that I have and not many others do, it's not going to work really in the short term anyway.
I agree. And unless the current battery technology we've got, there needs to be a step change, almost like a new technology that they discover to get the energy density to make them do 600-800 miles, which they need to do.
Yeah,
otherwise,
absolutely.
We won't be able to, there won't be mass adoption.
Yeah, and the one thing that the biggest factor of having spoken to a bunch of friends before actually taking delivery of the electric car that I've got in determining battery life is motorway driving and speed. And if you go at 60, which is, let's face it, you're going to get hooted and kind of flashed by people if you go at 60 on many motorways.
Yeah.
you're actually going to gain about 20. Yeah, you're going to gain about 25% of range. But surely that defeats the object. You know, what are we going to go back to the horse and cart, but meanwhile have a really sensible radius available to us?
Yeah, and this, do you know what? And this is a conversation that we have a lot on this podcast with various different people, and I think everybody, you know, pretty much universally, Jason, don't they? We, you know, we all come to this same conclusion, whereby, as you've rightly said, you know, they're a wonderful invention, and yes, of course, they are the future, and they're the future of a healthy and greener planet. But until the infrastructure is made certainly on a par with what we have at the moment with combustion engines, it's just not feasible. I mean, I've never owned one, but I can't imagine that sort of sense of panic. I mean, you know, I have a sense of panic sometimes when you run a bit low on petrol and you're kind of thinking, God, it's saying I've only got 20 miles and I don't know where the nearest thing is. But, you know, if when you've got that on a charge and you've got no idea where the next proper charge point is, or indeed how long it's going to take, I mean, you can't relax and travel around the country under those circumstances.
Yeah, and the shame is, I mean, the car, what I've got, which is this BMW 4x4, it goes like a rocket. The tech is incredible. The performance is incredible. The road holding is fabulous. The looks are good, but it's just missing these key ingredients.
Do you know what? I tested about 18 months ago. We went over to Norway, because that's kind of like the capital of EVs, electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And we tested a new technology by a company called NIO, and they had a system where on their sat nav you'd say, right, I need some charge, I need a battery, and you select on there, and it goes, oh, do you want a new battery? And you go, oh yeah, I'll have that.
Mm.
So then you drive up, you park the car on this in this blue box, you take your hands off the wheel, and then the car then automatically reverses in, gets lifted up, all by robots, new battery in.
Mm.
5 minutes in and out. That's what you want.
Yeah.
But anyway, they've got no plans to. That technology is in China now, and they're rolling out in Europe, but they're not planning to come to the UK.
Well, the infrastructure, I mean, that's a whole different kind of infrastructure that's required, isn't it? Similar to hydrogen. Yeah. I mean, there've been many people who've theorized that actually the future is hydrogen cars, which are the greenest of all, because of course the production of batteries, of lithium batteries, is hugely environmentally damaging. Mm. And you're running, most electricity is generated in this country, non-environmentally friendly fashion. We don't have much nuclear power in this country, whereas hydrogen, you know, you're spurting out a bit of water. The technology's there, but again, the infrastructure, I mean, it's by far the greenest form of technology, and of course you can refill vehicles with hydrogen very quickly, so the range issue is eliminated, but the infrastructure and the technology, the en masse technology is way behind.
Why is that, Jason, in terms of the fact that, you know, why haven't, you know, governments and population as a whole, why haven't they got behind the hydrogen thing and sort of backed that as almost the option of choice going forward? What are the downsides?
Do you know what? I think it's a little bit like Betamax and VHS.
Really?
In a really kind of, I mean, I know that's a strange analogy, but I think it is like that. You know, there's, you know, the electric way is a bit easier because we've all had electric motors. In fact, the first ever car was an electric car. First ever car in America. So, you know, electric motors have been around for years, but hydrogen powered cells have not been. And it just was a technology which has, you know, we've gone down the VHS route rather than Betamax, which we all know was a better product than VHS.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Jules, let's go back to some of the earlier cars. I think we've done electric now, and I think people are very clear on our general opinions. Back to the early days, young Judge Jules, bit of money in his pocket, likes to spend something on, you know, something a bit flash. You know, what are some of the early cars from your 20s, let's say?
Well, the first new car I bought was a Golf GTI convertible, which is the sort of classic shape GTI convertible in the late 80s, which was a sort of iconic, I don't know, iconic city boy car, even though I've never been a city boy, I've always been a DJ. And it was, I remember the day I bought it, I was that proud. but it didn't have power steering, and it was a ridiculously heavy car. Didn't have none of these sort of electrical sort of accoutrements that you associate with modern cars. Yeah. Didn't have a power hood. Didn't have it did have electric. It didn't have rear electric windows. It was just so dated by comparison to now, but it was still the car of the 80s, if you like, albeit the very late 80s into it. Might be in the very early 90s, actually, when I got it.
I was going to say, there's that and the Peugeot 205. They were the iconic.
They were. Hatches. I think the Golf, I think was, dare I say it, well, equally iconic, but probably one notch above the Peugeot in terms of engineering and build quality and what have you. But that was the last vehicle I ever had without power steering. And I could tell you, I mean, how anybody, you know, I was a robust kid in his early 20s, but how anybody who was a bit, you know, a smaller person could possibly have driven it. We take these sort of things so for granted now, don't we? We forget that tech is I really struggle with cars from prior to about 2010. 2010 is when all the important tech bits were in cars, you know, having USB or having Bluetooth. Even before 2010 or thereabouts, you couldn't Bluetooth your music into a car. And that's, that's absolutely essential, notwithstanding having something that sounds pretty good.
But it's weird, isn't it? When you do, as you say, we've all got so used to the fact that power steering is just standard on everything now, is that when you do ever get back into an old car, as you say, it's amazing how heavy they were. And this was just the norm, and sort of almost like wrestling with the steering wheel. You know, you couldn't sort of drive around as we do now and just sort of flicking it with a finger and stuff like that. It's incredibly heavy.
Well, that's why the driving, which they teach you, is so wrong. All this feed in the wheel, because you needed to do that back in the old days. Now you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Hey, so here's a question, Jules. Obviously, being into music, car hi-fi back in the 80s, 90s, it was something which, if you wanted good sound, you had to put it in yourself.
You certainly did.
Rip out the stand. So come on. Did you ever have a Nakamichi tape deck? Because that was the most amazing tape deck in the world.
I didn't. No, I had Blaupunkt. Blaupunkt was the thing, wasn't it?
Nice.
I did have a couple of my cars. I did sort of add some stereo stuff into, and then sort of later on, got into the era where they were beginning to put much better sound systems in. And now, I mean, my current main car, my GTC, has just got subwoofers. It's got, but it's all a standard. Yeah. The bar has been, and the BMW iX has got a really good sound system in it as well. I mean, I have a real problem as a DJ, as somebody who's lived my life with music. I have a real problem listening to, if anybody plays me a track on their phone, you know, straight out the phone speaker, it's like metal tip fingers down a blackboard. I find it absolutely horrific. Yeah. So, but I think the standard of the early cars, that sound systems that I probably had, would be no better than that. They were just terrible, weren't they? And you just took that for granted.
I was going to say, a lot of the guests we've all had, we all remember cutting the rear parcel shelf out and putting a pair of 6x9s in there, and, you know, all that sort of stuff, because the sounds were, they were crap, weren't they?
I created a box, actually, and did the same thing, open bottomed box in which I painted it black, stuck two huge speakers in there and wired that in, because I didn't want to chop into my car when I resold it.
Brilliant. And that was your sub in the boot?
Well, it was not in the boot. It was sort of on the rear parcel shelf. And it was...
Okay. Yeah,
it was loud, baby. It was loud.
You know, talking about putting different stereos and stuff, I just sort of had a flashback to the fact that I too had an early Golf GTI. It was a Mark II. It was a 1992 black one with the BBS wheels, a sort of classic shape. And it used to have the front of the stereo used to come off. Do you remember those things
it even
had like a little special case that you would put.
Well, it was to stop people stealing stereos.
Absolutely. It was. But rather than, because there was also the stereos that you could remove the whole thing. They came on a sort of like a handle. And if you were going into the pub, you could walk in with your stereo with a little handle, you know.
Isn't it mental?
But isn't it, when you think back to it now, the fact that, you know, you'd walk into the pub with you and put your stereo on the bar or on the table while you had a pint, so that someone wouldn't half inch it out of the car park. Yeah.
It was because, I suppose, that was a product of the fact that the inbuilt manufacturer-provided stereos were so terrible that everybody who was into music wanted to replace it with something better, whereas now, you know, the bog standard tends to be acceptable at the very least.
Oh, yeah.
So, Jules, we always believe that music and cars, it's a match made in heaven. It goes particularly well together. So just imagine it's your fantasy drive. You can choose any car. You know, where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? But most importantly, what are you in?
I mean, I genuinely have my dream car. I suppose if you wanted to go one up on a quite unrealistic level, you get one of the Rolls-Royce convertibles. But I just think Rolls-Royce is a little bit too flashy. But I, you know, from a fantasy perspective, let's go Rolls-Royce convertible. Driving down the highway north of Malibu, going up by the Pacific at sunset, coming out of Los Angeles, which you wouldn't be doing very quickly because the traffic there is so bad, heading eventually up to the sort of towards Northern California. And I guess for me, there's no middle ground. Either it's Café Del Mar stroke style of chill out albums or film scores for that kind of, but that's more a kind of daytime Balearic Mediterranean moment, or it's just make it absolutely banging, but you need crystal clear sound. You want 140 BPM, crystal clear sound at the severe risk of annoying everybody and looking like a complete knob. That's the way we go forward.
Mate, 140 BPM, there's a high chance I'd be off the road, I reckon.
I get too excited. I think so. You'd be taking a left straight into the drink, wouldn't you, on that road out of Los Angeles. And I'll tell you what, and then I think that maybe Jason and I should plot a little route and we should meet you somewhere for a sundown or somewhere on that road. There's got to be a nice little bar with a sea view. We could sit there with a couple of gin and tonics and all ready for your arrival. And I think on that note, Jason, and that beautiful image, I think you need to take us out.
He's not said yes yet.
Oh, it's a yes. Hold on, surely.
We need some commitment first before we're going out. He's nodded.
It's a yes. We'll say yes. It's a yes. It's a yes.
Right, well, with a yes to a fantastic meetup from Jules, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Judge Jules. Thanks, mate.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed. And I'll see you in the sunset in our respective vehicles.
Absolutely. We'll get a couple of cocktails on the go and some fancy umbrellas, and it will be all proper Del Boy, but we'll be there with bells on it. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time. I'm now off on the internet to try and find myself a fantastic old Mustang.